For years, even when it was a near monopoly, AT&T managed to do the impossible with a surprising degree of success. It managed to convince us that a huge corporation could be our friend.
That's just the way your dad used to hit him.
As I said, over the years, they managed this PR coup with a surprising degree of success, but not complete success. There was no denying the control that company had over our lives, which is why Ernestine, the telephone operator embodied by Lily Tomlin on the 1960s TV show Laugh-In, was so beloved.
Mr. Beadle, it's me again. We seem to be disconnected. Now, Mr. Beadle, I want you to understand something. We are not subject to city, state, or federal regulations. We are omnipotent. Omnipotent. That's potent with an omni in front of it.
She captured a theme that had been around for about a century of resistance or irritation with the telephone company.
Claude Fisher is a sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of A Social History of the Telephone. He says that AT&T has long contended with two views of itself: Ernestine's and the cozier one it wants to project. But he says if you go back a century, you find that reaching out and touching someone was the last thing on AT&T's mind. In fact, it actively opposed what it called idle chatter.
They would put notices in telephone directories about what the proper use of the telephone was, which was functional and quick and get off. That was the message for about the first half century of the history of the telephone, and it starts to change in the 1920s. When AT&T decides that they could actually make money by getting people to put in telephones and subscribe by making it a social device.
They just came to the conclusion that if people bought the phone and used it more, that they would make money?
The change in attitude, I think, occurs in a couple of ways. One is the realization that the automobile and other technologies, but notably the automobile, was making a far greater advance in the United States in the 1920s than the telephone. And one feature of the automobile in its early years, we don't think about it so much this way, is it was a leisure device. It was a device mostly for going out and having a good time. They always knew that customers tended to behave in this undesirable way of calling up friends and just sort of chatting away and gossiping and so forth on the phone. But they start to think that maybe this was something to encourage. And I think the major change was actually a changeover in the personnel that headed AT&T. The old line telephone people come out of the telegraph business. The new leaders of AT&T came from places like marketing or journalism. One of the new leaders of AT&T made a speech at a private conference saying that they'd been wrong all these years trying to suppress social conversation on the phone. He said it's as if the automobile industry had tried to tell customers, don't drive your car on Sundays, only use it to go to work.
Now, you write in your book that AT&T led the development of public relations in America. And part of the reason why is because it had to survive or overcome the image of being a huge monopoly with great tentacles, the Bell Octopus, so to speak.
That's right. They really pioneered public relations. One way they did it in an early part of the century was to use an outfit out of Boston called the Publicity Bureau, whose job it was to plant newspaper stories around the country, casting the telephone company in a good light. These stories included items on how operators had saved lives, or how repairmen had worked through blizzards, or how churches were finding new ways to use the telephone. Later on, in 1907 on, they engaged in large-scale advertising campaigns. They would put ads in prominent places with a message that the telephone industry was a service to the public, particularly AT&T, because it was so universal, it covered so much of the country. The kind of Lily Tomlin message always was in the background and always created some kind of tension. But over the years, the phone company did try very much to use what we now take for granted, PR, just creating good feelings about the company. That and making some concessions to public demand for telephones and to public regulation enabled the company to last very long into the 20th century.
But now that there is another company, it's not the same company, but another company with the same name, AT&T, will we see a resurgence of the same sort of widespread suspicion as that company gets bigger and bigger?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised. The environment is different, of course, with internet communications, email, cable, and so forth. And the proponents of the AT&T merger can argue that it no longer has quite the free hand it did. But I suspect that the larger the company gets, the more this is going to be a tension they have to deal with, dealing with politicians and dealing with voters. And I suspect that we'll see more and more advertisements on television and so forth dedicated to the proposition that the larger AT&T works for the greater good of the greatest number.
Claude Fisher, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Claude Fisher is a sociology professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of A Social History of the Telephone.
Oh, Mr. Beadle, I'm afraid we're going to have to discontinue your outgoing service. And if we do not receive payment within 10 days, we will send a large, burly serviceman to your home to rip it out of the wall. I'd advise you to lock up the liquor. He's a mean drunk. Now then, Mr. Beadle, wouldn't you really rather pay than lose your service and possibly the use of one eye? Mr. Beadle? Mr. Beadle?